Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The new superintendent of schools in Normandy wants to put schools there on a new path. We'll talk with Charles Pearson a little bit later. But first, a local author is about to embark on a path to the past, a nearly 1,000-mile journey to the sites of historic World War II battlefields, battlefields where his grandfather once fought. It's all for a good cause, and you can get involved if you like. With me in studio to talk about his path to the past is author-historian Lou Bakshevsky. Lou, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I think we'd better explain in a little more detail what Path to the Past is.
Well, essentially, Path to the Past is a two-pronged attack, so to speak, on trying to raise money for veterans, but using my grandfather's story to do so and following the path that the 3rd Armored Division took during World War II.
What put you on this path to get all of this going?
Well, it's been a long process. About 13 years ago, I actually started writing the story about my grandfather and working with him, trying to document what his experiences were. Initially, it started as just interviews to save it for the family, but then I came to discover he had a remarkable experience, and we didn't realize what we were doing at the time, but came to find out that it was actually what they call narrative therapy, and it helps veterans very much. And at first, he was very reluctant to speak about his experiences, and knowing how graphic they were now, I can understand why, or at least try to understand. As I have not experienced combat myself. But the more and more we dug into it, the more we realized that this had to be put down on paper. And
go ahead. So,
but after putting it down as a story, I've been doing a lot of veterans events and different things in the St. Louis area and thought that how could I really kind of go back into the story, talk about it and tell it through his eyes as well as do something good for veterans now who are having a tough time due to all the deployments and the situations they're facing.
We'll get into some detail about the battles that he was involved in, including the Battle of the Bulge. But anybody who was involved in that war and in those places that we'll be talking about have remarkable stories to tell. Why is your grandfather's, do you think, more remarkable?
I think it's because he narrowly survived 5 major campaigns and was actually one of 18 out of 152 in his company to survive that entire trek. And so he had a perspective that was more broad than the average soldier. And he also served in a tank, which was a very inadequate weapon, the Sherman tank, which was very outgunned. And they actually had a 580% loss ratio of tanks. And each time a tank would be lost, 1.5 men on average would die.
Right. You detailed all of this in an earlier book, did you not?
Yes, sir. The book is called Luch. It was my grandfather's nickname. It was short for Luchik. He grew up in Pocahontas, Illinois. And he was the son of immigrant parents who just came from Poland and spoke broken English, so they would call him Luchik. And the neighborhood kids that he grew up with kind of changed that around into Luch.
He was born in this country or born in Poland?
He was born here.
Yeah.
But he actually didn't speak English until he went to school. He was raised speaking Polish.
Right. Where did the campaign start for him, and in what year?
He was drafted in 43, in early 43 in February, and did some tank training here domestically and then more tank training in England, but then was deployed after D-Day, D-Day plus 17, actually.
Mm-hmm. And where did he start? Where was battle number one for him?
They landed on Omaha Beach, but didn't hit any resistance in that landing because the beachhead was established at that point. But they moved into an area called Insigne-sur-Mer. And right there when they crossed the Vera River Bridge, they started fighting, and they fought all the way from there into Germany.
What did your grandfather tell you in these narratives about the experience? And we'll kind of take it step by step, but his introduction to combat.
His first night, he said that he realized that night that his chances of surviving were very slim. He really accepted the fact that he was probably going to die. And that was one of the more poignant moments in the book, is discussing that first night. He said after – and they actually ran into the Panzer Lehr division in his first days of combat, which was a very elite German SS tank division. And they had a high amount of casualties. Initially, they lost within the first less than 10 days 80 tanks out of the 232 that they initially had.
And of course, landing at Omaha Beach even 17 days after D-Day, they were well aware of what had happened on the 6th of June.
Sure.
Which I guess fueled the fatalism that he might have felt.
Right, and they could see the aftermath there was all around them. So once they moved in from the beachhead, it was a continual battle all the way through. And unlike some outfits that would be – they would be pulled off the line here and there sporadically, but they fought continuously all the way. Sometimes they actually fought so long that their uniforms were rotting on them, where they were trapped in the tanks and they couldn't get relief. Because the tank units, the 3rd Armored, would they were called the spearhead specifically. And they would spearhead holes into the German lines. And in doing so, they had to just continually fight. They actually fought surrounded numerous times throughout the war.
And yet you speak of 5 separate battles, specific battles.
What they call 5 major campaigns, which would have been the Normandy area, central France, then Belgium. Then the Battle of the Bulge is actually a separate – it's not a campaign, so it's really 6 major operations. But then Germany and central Germany.
And, of course, the Germans, as their homeland was being neared by the American forces on the west and the then Soviet forces on the east, were fighting a little bit harder than they might have earlier in the war.
Certainly. In France, they did fight as hard as they could, but there were some tactical decisions that were made on the German command that hindered them to some extent. And the divisions that we faced in France were actually minimalized by the combat in Russia. Mm-hmm. And what I think in movies they don't necessarily depict is that we had a hard-fought war. It's not to negate anything that we accomplished. But the Russians bore most of the brunt of the fight in Europe. It's estimated they lost somewhere around 26 to even maybe even 28 million people, whereas we lost around in the whole war in its entirety around over 400,000.
And most of those were lost in Russia itself during the German campaign there. As you spoke to your grandfather. You spoke earlier to us here about the therapeutic nature of these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see a change in him as these conversations continued? Did they change as he talked about it?
He was reluctant, as I say, at first to speak about it. But the more he talked, the more it actually opened a wellspring of conversation. And he was as eager to talk about it as I at a certain point. And he went back and read his after-combat reports, which I was able to get from the University of Illinois. And things started to come back to him. He had buried it so deeply. But still, even then, when he had a interest in telling the stories, he at a point would have to stop. And certain nights he would say, well, I'm going to have nightmares about this. Mm-hmm. If I continue to talk. Because even in his 80s, it still haunted him.
Is he alive?
No, unfortunately, he passed 2 years ago, right about this time.
You know, I've interviewed many World War II veterans, and any that saw combat and any that saw friends die could never get through a conversation without weeping.
He was the same when he would talk about certain individuals. For example, his tank commander, Joe Cady, was a hero, and he had a remarkable skill for standing up to officers when they were about to be put in a situation that would have otherwise killed them if he hadn't have stood up. For example, Joe Key, they were still in France, and a major – they were stalling. They would have to take the roads because they were dug in and they would form in a column. And so that didn't allow them to follow their normal tactics where you were supposed to fight tanks abreast where they could seek out targets and so forth. So one tank basically was taking all the fire. And they were the lead tank that particular day, and Joe Cady was waiting for the infantry to run up and take a report. and to see what was ahead of them. And they knew the Germans were wise to create ambushes ahead of them. And a major named Major Crosby came riding up on a Jeep and said, "Hey, let's get up the road. Let's go, let's go." And there's nothing up there. Intelligence says there's nothing there. And Sergeant Katie said, "Oh, okay." He said, "If there's nothing there," he said, "get your, you know, butt up here on this tank." He used other words that I can't say on the radio, but hop up here on this tank, Major, and we'll go. You know, as long as you're up here riding with us, we'll head up there. And he said that a few times in front of the Major's back down and said, "Well, let's wait for the infantry to come back and see what's up there." And actually, there were two dug-in 88-millimeter cannons up that road, and I probably wouldn't be here had they rode up there, because the 88 could actually penetrate a Sherman with impunity. He saw on some occasions where the shell would go through both sides of the tank.
What did he have to say about the Battle of the Bulge?
That, as I told you earlier, was the worst experience of his life, is what he would say. When it would be cold outside and say we were working his house, he would, we'd complain, "Oh, it's cold." He said, "Well, you don't have anybody shooting at you, though, and it's not as cold as it was in the Bulge." He fought all the way through into Germany. They were actually the first outfit into Germany in force in the American lines. But when the 1st SS Panzer Division, which was actually Hitler's own division, crossed the Losheim Gap and pushed its way into the Battle of the Bulge, they came down and cut them off from supplies. And in doing so, they hit staggering resistance. They were wiped out. Actually, in one engagement in the town of Charain, Belgium, the last tank in the outfit, actually, they went into a town 10 tanks strong, and typically they had 17 in a company. They were down to 10. Every tank was wiped out. 100 infantry were killed, and my grandfather's tank was the only tank left that day.
Total desperation on the part of the Germans at this point.
Correct. They sent in all the remnants that were not destroyed in the Battle of Falaise. Earlier in France, we did encircle our forces with the Poles and Canadians and British to the north of them, encircled a huge part of Panzer Group West. And the remnants of those groups were actually some of the best German soldiers. And that's what caused the bulge that they were propelling them.
I have to take a break now. We'll do that, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about exactly how you're going to honor the service of your grandfather and the others who fought, all part of the greatest generation, needless to say. I'm talking with Lou Bekshevsky, and we're talking about his Path to the Past campaign, which is going to get underway in just a couple of weeks. Back in just a moment to continue the conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Lou Bekshevsky. He is a historian and an author, and we're talking about something called A Path to the Past. Let's talk about specifically what you're going to do, because it's quite unique. This is not just an auto trip through parts of France and other countries. You're going to do it by bike. Why?
Well, my thought was that if my grandfather had to take this whole distance in a substandard tank, then I ought to make it a little bit hard on myself. So, and to see the countryside personally on the ground. I think riding through it in a car, I'm not going to be able to experience it as well as I would riding a bike. And it's going to be an interesting trek for me day to day to do something where I can really get my feet on the ground with the bicycle and so forth.
And you're not going to be alone?
No. I have a friend and a former student that is actually a student at OMSL. And he's doing an internship to film this. So we're actually filming a documentary about the process. We did have an unfortunate person back out on riding with me, and we're looking to see if anybody is interested. We're looking for worthy candidates who would be willing to ride about 1,500 kilometers through Europe.
Yeah, that's a little under 1,000 miles, just about 1,000 miles.
Correct.
What qualifications would such a person have to have, aside from strong legs?
Well, a willingness to ride a bike, obviously, but also we're looking for a French speaker or a German speaker, somebody that has research or production experience, and we could possibly split it between two-week periods and maybe have somebody do for a few weeks and then fly out, and we do have some resources to get free airfare possibly.
Well, you're starting in the middle of June. And how long do you think this is going to take you to complete the trip?
The estimate is about 50 miles a day would be a comfortable ride. So that if we did 20 days for 50 miles a day, then that comes up to about 900 miles.
You'll be interviewing people along the way, I assume, is for the documentary.
Yes.
And what will be the approach in talking to them, asking them if they remember this 60 years ago or what?
Our hope is in the coming weeks we're making some inroads to French embassy, Belgian embassy, American embassies in those countries and Germany as well. And trying to set up resources to make contacts there that would come out and actually meet us and let them know what we're doing. Because we definitely want to have a diversified perspective in this movie and then try to see if we could find any survivors that recognize the third coming through or knew were young people. And we actually have some pictures we're sending forward of my grandfather celebrating with different civilians in Belgium and hoping to find if we could find those actual people.
We'll get your contact information, by the way, in case anyone listening would like to be a part of your group. Put it on our website at sdlpublicradio.org.
That'd be fantastic.
My understanding, Lou, is that you're looking for public funding for this as well. Is that correct?
Yes, we're hoping to get some sponsors and corporate or organizational help to aid in our fundraising. And we're distributing the money to three different veterans groups. Mm-hmm. Rather than just give it to one specific group, I thought it would be better that it would be spread about different areas where veterans can get help for various things. One is the Paralyzed Veterans of America, the Gateway Chapter. They do a lot of things for veterans that have spinal injuries or paralysis for whatever reason. And they try to make paralyzed vets live a enjoyable life and make their life as best they can despite their ailments. Another chapter or another group would be the Fisher House of St. Louis, and they help veterans with health care issues. They could stay at the Fisher House, which is with the VA at Jefferson Barracks, and they also help families through that process of getting medical treatment. Heroes Care, on the other hand, they help specifically serving military families. If they need help in any way, care packages, even just resources of people to come to their home and help them through troubling times because a loved one is deployed, they do remarkable things. And all of these entities have a great ratio of spending versus administrative costs.
Most of the money is going to go where it's intended to
exactly.
go and not into someone's pocket who's running the show, right?
90 cents on a dollar or better on each entity.
That's pretty good in today's world.
Correct.
What sort of financial goals have you set?
We're hoping to raise at least with the – we're selling kilometers of the bike ride. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you can honor a veteran. And each time we finish, say, 50 miles – we will read those veterans' names in honor of those kilometers. So it's a neat way – with just a $20 donation that an everyday person can honor somebody that served now or that served years ago. We will also have other inroads that they can use as well. They can contact PVA is actually handling all the funds.
Okay, and we'll have all of that information again on our website. Aside from the fact that you wanted to honor your grandfather, obviously you're a historian and have a great interest in this particular part of history. What brought you into this?
Well, actually, it was when I was younger, my grandfather would take me fishing on Shoal Creek, which is a creek outside of Pocahontas, Illinois. And he grew up there with a lot of friends that grew up fishing in this kind of caveman-like manner, really. It's a Paleolithic undertaking. It's using limb lines and trout lines and so forth. And in teaching us those things at night, my whole family, my uncles, brother, cousins, and so forth, he would tell stories after dark when the sun went down about his friends or growing up at Pokey in poverty. And it was through that I really wanted to write a story. And the story about my grandfather isn't about war per se or about just his experience in the war. It's more about him as a human being and what he did or how much impact he had on our family because he survived these things. Mm-hmm. And he was really a remarkable individual, and that drove me to write this story.
Is there one most unforgettable story that he told you, the one you just can't shake?
His favorite story, and especially being of Polish origin, was I'm ruining a bit of the book, I suppose, but it's a fantastic story. At the end of the war, he had seen an unspeakable amount of combat and, as I said, a lot of loss, and they also liberated Dora Mittelbau concentration camp where he saw tens of thousands of bodies there and so forth. So he was scarred at this point, but he found a remarkable point in the war where he could pull some good out of that, and he always remembered doing so. At the end of the war, there were a lot of towns in Germany where it's mixed Polish and German. And he, being a fluent Polish speaker, he was able to help some Poles at the war. There was a Polish person that was running along the lines of tanks, and this was just right after the war ended, and no one could understand what he was saying. He was trying to get help, and he didn't speak German or English. So eventually he ran past my grandfather's tank, and he overheard him speaking in Polish, and said he stopped the tank. And at that point, he had a little bit of clout, having survived all that, and he was a sergeant by that point, started the war as a private. And he stopped the whole column and went to help this man. And the man explained in Polish and was so excited to be able to speak to someone in Polish and explained that there was the only resource for food in town was a baker shop. And the baker must have had some Nazi sympathies or had an issue with Poles, but he wouldn't even barter bread to the Poles that were in the town. So Grandpa, rather than just give him some rations, he said, let's go down there and talk to this baker. So they went into the baker shop, and he told him and said, well, this guy gets whatever he wants today for free. And so he loaded himself up, and the man with tears in his eyes kept saying, dziękuję, dziękuję, which is Polish for thank you. And he disappeared and headed out to his family with an armful of bread and other items. And the next day, my grandfather was staying at a home, and his lieutenant walked in and said, I think there's some people looking for you out here, Luch. And he said, what do you mean? He said, there's a bunch of people who keep saying Polski GI, Polski GI. And so he walked outside, and there were 30 or 40 Poles that were starving. And there were young children and older people and just people of all ages that could not find food. And so he said, okay, all of you, you know, come with me, and we're going to walk down to this baker shop. And so he proceeded to go in there, and he cleaned them out. And so everybody loaded up with bread. But the amazing thing that showed the character of my grandfather, you know, as part of a conquering army, he could have roughed the man up. He could have done other things. But instead, he was fair with the man, and he said, okay, they get their food for free today. But every day past this, if they come and they want to pay or they want to barter bread, you sell it to them.
You do it.
And I better hear nothing to the contrary.
Sounds like quite a guy.
He was.
Right. Lou, I want to thank you for being with us. Good luck with your campaign. Again, we'll put the contact information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. And when you're finished with this trip, we'd like to hear from you, find out how it went, okay?
Well, I would love that opportunity. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Lou Bekshevsky. And the Path to the Past campaign is going to begin in just a couple of weeks, that bike trek through Europe. It's going to be quite a trip. Thank you again.